Lowe's knows how to set off your July 4th with savings. Right now, buy one, get one free on select one-coat coverage interior paint via Visa gift card rebate. Plus, get two select 2 or 2.5-quart red, white, and blue annuals for just $10. Hurry, these July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, excludes Alaska and Hawaii. More terms and restrictions apply. See Lowe's.com/rebates for more details.
Message and data rates may apply. Reply stop to opt out. Consult a doctor prior to use.
You look amazing. What have you been doing?
You've heard of Ozempic, Wegovy, and other GLP-1 medications, right? Well, if you qualify, Zelthy providers can prescribe semaglutide, the same active ingredient, at up to 90% less without insurance. Done all online.
No wait at the doctor's office or pharmacy?
No wait. Zelthy can ship the same active ingredients as other expensive GLP-1s to your door.
Get started with Zelthy today for just $39. Call #250 and say keyword care. That's the same active ingredients in Wegovy or Ozempic, but for 80 to 90% less. That's #250 keyword care.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair has got style tips for every home. This is Nicole Byer, helping you make those rooms flyer. Today's style tip, when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild! Like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Ooh, fierce! This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
At 3 a.m. on December 30th, 2022, in the quiet suburbs of L. Brightsville, Pennsylvania, a team of law enforcement officers surrounded a modest two-story house where a family was sleeping peacefully. The house sat on a tree-lined street in the Pocono Mountains, about 90 miles north of Philadelphia, in a community where violent crime was virtually unknown. What happened next would shock the nation and finally provide answers to a case that had captivated America for nearly 7 weeks. The suspect they were about to arrest wasn't hiding in some remote location or living under an assumed identity. He was spending the holidays with his parents, 2,500 miles from the scene of the crime, apparently confident that he had committed the perfect murders. The arrest would mark the end of one of the most intensive manhunts in recent memory, the beginning of what promised to be one of the most closely watched criminal trials in American history. For 47 days, investigators had worked around the clock, processed thousands of tips, analyzed terabytes of digital evidence, and employed some of the most advanced forensic techniques available to law enforcement. Previously on Brian Koberger, How We Got Here. December 2022 became the month of breakthrough discoveries. Advanced genetic genealogy work proceeded in secret while investigators conducted a massive search for a white Hyundai Elantra. Digital forensics revealed months of surveillance activity, with the suspect's phone connecting to cell towers near the victim's house 12 times before mysteriously going dark during the murders. On December 27th and 28th, FBI agents secretly collected DNA evidence from trash outside the Koberger family home in Pennsylvania, achieving a 99.99998% match with the knife sheath found at the crime scene. I'm Tony Bruschi, and this is our look back on how we got here in the case against Brian Koberger. And this is episode 5, Breaking News, The Arrest and Revelations. Today we're talking about the pre-dawn arrest that stunned the nation, the shocking details revealed in the probable cause affidavit, and how a criminology PhD student's own academic expertise in criminal behavior became evidence against him in one of the most documented murder cases in recent history. The Pennsylvania State Police had been conducting surveillance of the Koberger family home for several days before the arrest. This wasn't casual observation. It was a carefully planned operation involving multiple law enforcement agencies and sophisticated surveillance techniques. Undercover officers had been monitoring the house from concealed positions, documenting who came and went, noting daily routines, and confirming that Brian Koberger was indeed present at the residence. They had observed his white Hyundai Elantra parked in the driveway, the same vehicle that had been the subject of a nationwide search for weeks. The surveillance team had also noted the family's normal activities to ensure they could execute the arrest with minimal risk to innocent family members. They knew that Koberger's parents were elderly and that there were no other family members or visitors in the house who might complicate the arrest operation. Intelligence gathered during the surveillance period indicated that Koberger had been behaving normally during his time in Pennsylvania, spending time with family, running errands, and giving no outward indication that he suspected he was under investigation. This behavior would later be analyzed by criminal psychologists as potentially indicating either genuine confidence in his ability to evade detection or sophisticated psychological compartmentalization. The decision about when and how to execute the arrest involved careful consideration of multiple factors. Investigators wanted to minimize the risk of violence, ensure that Koberger couldn't destroy evidence, and avoid creating a spectacle that might compromise the ongoing investigation or traumatize the local community. The arrest team was a joint operation involving Pennsylvania State Police, FBI agents, Monroe County Sheriff's deputies, and local law enforcement from the Pocono Mountain Regional Police. The team included tactical officers, evidence technicians, and specialists trained in high-risk arrest procedures. They had planned the operation meticulously over several days, studying aerial photographs and blueprints of the house, identifying all possible exits and escape routes, and coordinating their movements to ensure Koberger couldn't escape or destroy evidence. The planning process included contingencies for various scenarios. What if he was armed? What if he tried to flee? What if he barricaded himself inside the house? The tactical plan called for simultaneous entry through multiple points to prevent escape and minimize the time Koberger would have to react. Officers were positioned at the front door, back door, and basement exit, while additional personnel secured the perimeter to catch anyone who might try to flee on foot. The team also included evidence specialists who would be responsible for securing any potential evidence found during the arrest and subsequent search of the premises. They brought evidence collection kits, cameras, and other equipment needed to properly document anything they might find. At exactly 3 a.m., officers executed the arrest warrant with precision that reflected their extensive planning. They chose this early morning hour for several tactical reasons. The family would likely be asleep and less likely to resist. Neighbors would be less likely to be awake and interfere, and there would be minimal traffic or bystanders to complicate the operation. The pre-dawn timing also provided a psychological advantage. People awakened suddenly from deep sleep are typically disoriented and less likely to make rational decisions about resistance or escape. This timing is standard for high-priority arrests where officers want to maintain maximum control over the situation. When officers entered the house, they found Brian Koberger in his bedroom, reportedly wearing latex gloves and sorting trash into separate Ziploc bags. This detail would later be seen as potentially significant behavior. Someone who was conscious of leaving DNA evidence might take unusual precautions, even in their own home. The scene that officers encountered was both mundane and deeply unsettling. Here was a graduate student in his parents' house engaged in what appeared to be obsessive cleaning behavior at 3 a.m. The latex gloves and methodical trash sorting suggested someone who understood the importance of DNA evidence and was taking extraordinary precautions to avoid leaving traces. Criminal behavior experts would later analyze this scene as potentially indicative of paranoid behavior brought on by the stress of evading a murder investigation. The fact that Koberger was awake and engaged in evidence-conscious activities at 3 a.m. suggested that he might not have been sleeping well or might have been suffering from anxiety about his eventual capture. The officers' training had prepared them for various scenarios they might encounter during the arrest, but finding a suspect engaged in this type of methodical, evidence-conscious behavior was unusual and immediately noted in their arrest reports. Koberger was taken into custody without incident. According to police reports, he appeared surprised by the arrest but didn't resist or attempt to flee. His reaction was described as calm and resigned, as if he had been expecting this moment even while hoping it wouldn't come. His parents, Michael and Marianne Koberger, were awakened by the commotion and were reportedly shocked and confused by what was happening. Neighbors later described seeing multiple police vehicles with flashing lights surrounding the house, a sight that was completely out of the ordinary for their quiet suburban street. The family's reaction would be described by law enforcement as typical of people who had no knowledge of their family members' alleged criminal activity. Both parents appeared genuinely shocked and distressed by the arrest, and they cooperated fully with investigators. The arrest warrant charged Koberger with 4 counts of first-degree murder in the deaths of Kaylee Gonsalves, Madison Mogan, Ethan Chapin, and Zonneker Nodal, plus 1 count of burglary for unlawfully entering the house at 1122 King Road. Under Idaho law, first-degree murder charges can carry the death penalty, making this potentially a capital case. The legal significance of these charges was enormous. First-degree murder in Idaho requires proof of premeditation and deliberation, meaning prosecutors would need to demonstrate that Koberger planned the murders in advance rather than committing them in the heat of passion. The evidence of months of surveillance suggested that proving premeditation might not be difficult. The burglary charge was also strategically important for prosecutors. In Idaho, burglary during which someone is killed can be charged as felony murder, which also carries the possibility of the death penalty. This gave prosecutors multiple legal pathways to seek capital punishment if they chose to do so. The charges also carried the possibility of life in prison without parole if prosecutors decided not to seek the death penalty or if the death penalty was ruled out for other reasons. Either way, if convicted, Koberger was facing the possibility of never being free again. News of the arrest broke within hours, first through law enforcement sources and then through official statements from the Moscow Police Department and Idaho State Police. The announcement sent shockwaves through the communities of Moscow, Idaho, and Pullman, Washington, where residents had been living in fear for nearly 7 weeks. The initial news reports were sparse on details, but the basic facts were stunning. A 28-year-old criminology graduate student from nearby Washington State University had been arrested in Pennsylvania for the murders. The proximity of the suspect to the crime scene and his academic background studying criminal behavior created an immediate sensation in both traditional and social media. For residents of Moscow and Pullman, the revelation that the alleged killer had been living and studying just 8 miles from the crime scene was both relieving and deeply unsettling. Many people had assumed that the killer was either a stranger passing through the area or someone from much farther away. The reality that he had been part of the local academic community was shocking. Brian Christopher Koberger was 28 years old, a criminology PhD student at Washington State University, who had been studying criminal behavior and forensic techniques. The irony was impossible to ignore. A man who studied how criminals are caught had allegedly committed one of the most brutal crimes in Idaho's recent history. Koberger's academic background made the case even more disturbing for multiple reasons. He held bachelor's and master's degrees in psychology and criminal justice from DeSales University in Pennsylvania, where he had graduated with honors and been recognized for academic excellence. His undergraduate work had focused on psychology with an emphasis on criminal behavior, and his master's degree had specifically concentrated on criminal justice administration. He was in his first semester of a PhD program in criminal justice and criminology at Washington State University, where he had been working as a teaching assistant in the Department of Criminal Justice and Criminology. His graduate assistantship included teaching undergraduate courses and assisting faculty with research projects. His area of academic focus was particularly chilling, given the charges against him. According to his graduate school application and academic records that would later be obtained by media outlets, Koberger was interested in studying how emotions and psychological traits influence decision-making when committing a crime. He had written about wanting to understand the psychology of criminals and the factors that drive them to offend. His master's thesis at DeSales University had examined how criminals choose their victims and make decisions during the commission of crimes. The thesis, titled Progression of a Criminal Mind, A Look at Criminals' Psychological Development, had involved conducting surveys and interviews with convicted criminals about their thought processes and motivations. In the thesis, Koberger had written about wanting to understand what drives someone to commit a crime knowing the potential consequences. and how offenders rationalize their behavior to themselves and others. He had also expressed interest in studying the development of criminal thinking patterns from adolescence into adulthood. Now, he was accused of putting that academic knowledge to use in the most horrific way possible. The research he had conducted into criminal behavior, victim selection, and crime scene decision-making appeared to have provided him with a roadmap for planning and executing murders. The arrest also revealed details about Koberger's behavior in the weeks following the murders that had raised red flags among those who knew him. According to court documents and witness statements that would emerge over the following weeks, his demeanor had changed noticeably after November 13th in ways that colleagues and students found concerning. Students in his criminology classes at Washington State University reported that he had become increasingly erratic and aggressive in his teaching style after the murders. Several students told investigators that his behavior in class had become unpredictable, with him sometimes becoming visibly agitated during discussions of criminal cases or forensic techniques. Some students reported that he had made inappropriate comments about the Idaho murders, showing what they described as an unusual and unsettling interest in the details of the case. Unlike the normal academic discussion that might be expected in a criminology class, his comments were described as personal and intense in a way that made students uncomfortable. One student told investigators that Koberger had asked the class how they thought the killer might have avoided being caught, a question that seemed to go beyond normal academic inquiry into something more personal and concerning. Another student reported that he had made comments about how investigators might be making mistakes in their handling of the case. His fellow graduate students and professors had also noticed significant changes in his behavior and personality. Colleagues described him as becoming increasingly isolated and withdrawn, missing social events and academic gatherings that he had previously attended regularly. When he did interact with others, he seemed nervous, distracted, and sometimes paranoid. Faculty members who worked with him noted that his academic performance had declined noticeably after November 13th. He missed deadlines for assignments, showed up late to teaching responsibilities, and seemed unable to concentrate on his coursework. This was particularly notable because his previous academic record had been exemplary. On December 19th, just 11 days before his arrest, Koberger had been terminated from his teaching assistant position at WSU for what university officials described as behavioral concerns. The exact nature of these concerns wasn't made public, but the timing suggested his behavior had become sufficiently problematic to warrant immediate action by the university. According to sources within the university, the decision to terminate his assistantship was made after multiple complaints from students and faculty about his erratic behavior. The university had also received reports that he was making inappropriate comments about ongoing criminal cases, including the Idaho murders. The arrest warrant and the initial court documents revealed that investigators had been watching Koberger for some time before deciding to make the arrest. The probable cause affidavit, which would be released publicly on January 5th, 2023, would provide stunning details about the evidence against him. But even before the affidavit was released, some details about the case began to emerge through law enforcement sources and court proceedings. The DNA evidence from the knife sheath was described as a strong match to samples collected from Koberger. Cell phone tower data had placed his phone in the area of the murders multiple times over several months. The white Hyundai Elantra that investigators had been seeking was registered to Koberger and matched the description of the vehicle seen in surveillance footage near the crime scene. Vehicle records showed that Koberger had driven the car from Washington to Pennsylvania in mid-December, making the cross-country trip that had included the two suspicious traffic stops in Indiana. His extradition hearing was scheduled for January 3, 2023, in Pennsylvania. Koberger had the right to fight extradition, which could delay his transfer to Idaho for weeks or months. However, his defense attorneys indicated that he would waive his right to an extradition hearing and agree to be transferred to Idaho to face the charges. The news of Koberger's arrest was met with a mixture of relief and disbelief in the communities most affected by the case. For the families of the victims, the arrest represented a crucial step toward justice, though it couldn't bring back their loved ones or undo the trauma they had endured. Steve Gonsalves, Kaylee's father, released a statement expressing gratitude to law enforcement for their tireless work on the case. He also emphasized that while the arrest was important, the legal process was just beginning, and his family would continue to seek justice for their daughter. The University of Idaho community also reacted with a mixture of relief and continued caution. While the arrest suggested that the immediate threat had been removed, many students and faculty remained shaken by the realization that the alleged killer had been living and working so close to their campus. For the residents of Moscow, the arrest provided some answers, but also raised new questions. How had someone living just 8 miles away been able to commit such brutal crimes without being detected sooner? What had motivated someone with no apparent connection to the victims to target them specifically? The academic community was particularly shaken by the revelation that the suspect was a graduate student in criminology. Universities pride themselves on being places of learning and intellectual growth, not breeding grounds for violent criminals. The fact that Koberger had been studying criminal behavior while allegedly planning and executing murders created an uncomfortable examination of academic programs that study criminal justice. Washington State University immediately distanced itself from Koberger, emphasizing that his alleged actions were completely contrary to the values and mission of the institution. The university also announced that it would be reviewing its graduate admissions processes and student monitoring procedures to determine if any changes were needed. The arrest also had significant implications for the ongoing investigation. While Koberger was in custody, investigators continued to search for evidence that might strengthen their case or reveal additional details about the murders. They executed search warrants for his apartment in Pullman, his office at the university, and any other locations where he might have stored evidence. The search of Koberger's apartment reportedly yielded additional evidence, though the specific details weren't immediately made public. Investigators were looking for anything that might connect him to the victims or the crime scene, computer files, photographs, weapons, or personal items that might have belonged to the victims. They were also analyzing his digital footprint more thoroughly now that they knew his identity. This included examining his internet search history, social media activity, and any online communications that might provide insights into his motivations or planning for the crimes. The cell phone tower data that had initially helped identify Koberger as a suspect was now being analyzed in even greater detail. Investigators wanted to understand not just when his phone was in the area of the victim's house, but also his patterns of movement and behavior over the months leading up to the murders. One particularly disturbing aspect of the digital evidence was the pattern of surveillance that emerged from the cell phone data. According to court documents, Koberger's phone had connected to towers near the victim's house at least 12 times between June and November 2022, always during nighttime hours. This wasn't someone who happened to be in the area occasionally for legitimate reasons. This was someone who was repeatedly visiting the area, always under cover of darkness, in what appeared to be a pattern of stalking or surveillance. The timing of these visits was also significant. They had begun in June 2022. Shortly after Koberger arrived in the area to begin his graduate studies at WSU, this suggested that he'd identified his targets relatively soon after arriving in the Pacific Northwest and had spent months planning and preparing for the attack. During the crucial time window when the murders occurred between 2:47 a.m. and 4:48 a.m. on November 13th, Koberger's phone had mysteriously gone dark. The device either had been turned off or had been placed in airplane mode, preventing it from connecting to any cell towers during the time when four people were being murdered. This type of behavior, suddenly ceasing normal phone activity during the commission of a crime, is something that digital forensics experts recognize as evidence of consciousness of guilt. Most people keep their phones active constantly, so a deliberate decision to turn off a phone during a specific time period often indicates awareness that the phone's location data could be incriminating. Even more suspicious was what happened after the murders. Koberger's phone reconnected to the cellular network at 4:48 a.m., just as investigators believed the killer was leaving the area. Phone records showed that he returned to the vicinity of the crime scene around 9:12 a.m. the same morning, apparently to observe the police response to the discovery of the bodies. This behavior of returning to the scene of the crime is something that law enforcement agencies recognize as common among certain types of killers. Some criminals are compelled to return to crime scenes to observe the investigation, relive their crimes, or ensure that they haven't left behind evidence that could incriminate them. The January 5th release, the probable cause affidavit, would provide even more shocking details about the evidence against Koberger. The document would reveal that investigators had surveillance footage showing his vehicle making multiple passes by the victim's house before and after the murders, suggesting that he had conducted reconnaissance before the attack and had returned afterward to assess the scene. The affidavit would also reveal that DNA evidence from the knife sheath wasn't the only genetic evidence linking Koberger to the crime. Investigators had found what they described as additional DNA evidence at the scene, though the specific details of this evidence weren't included in the public version of the document. Perhaps most chillingly, the affidavit would reveal details about witness Dylan Mortensen's description of the figure she saw leaving the house. Her description of a male approximately 5 feet 10 inches with bushy eyebrows closely matched Koberger's physical appearance, providing crucial eyewitness evidence to supplement the DNA and digital evidence. As news of the arrest spread across the country, it became clear that this case would continue to captivate public attention through the legal proceedings that lay ahead. The evidence against Koberger appeared substantial, but criminal trials can be unpredictable, especially in death penalty cases where the stakes are highest. The arrest also marked the beginning of what would likely be a long and complex legal process. Death penalty cases typically take years to resolve, involving extensive pretrial motions, jury selection challenges, and appeals processes that can extend the proceedings for decades. For the families of the victims, the arrest represented justice beginning to take its course, but they knew that their journey through the legal system was just beginning. They would need to prepare for the possibility of testifying in court, reliving the trauma of their losses, and facing the person accused of taking their loved ones from them. For the communities of Moscow and Pullman, the arrest provided some closure, but also forced them to confront uncomfortable questions about safety, trust, and the possibility that dangerous people can hide in plain sight among us. Brian Koberger's academic interest in criminal psychology had led him to study how criminals think and behave. Now he was about to become the subject of exactly the kind of criminal case analysis he had once studied as a graduate student. The irony was as chilling as it was complete. Next time on Brian Koberger, how we got here. The shocking revelations in the probable cause affidavit, Koberger's first court appearance, and the family's emotional reactions, and how the academic world grappled with the realization that someone studying criminal justice had allegedly become the very type of criminal he claimed to want to understand.